This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a foggy Thursday this morning. Walking into work, the fog was really dense on the Columbia River. It's remarkable. In Washington, D.C., a New York man was planning to blow up a bomb. By the way, we've got a lot of the program today. Dr. Michael Mann will be with us in about 25 minutes, 30 minutes. Congressman Mark Pocan will be with us for the entire second hour of the show, taking your calls. And we got the three of the strangest headlines for our third hour about Fox News, Melania, and eating glue. We'll get to all that. But I wanted to start out by talking about sortition.
Sortition? What's that?
Sortition, well, back to the New York guy who built this 200-pound bomb that he wanted to blow up on the National Mall. They just arrested him yesterday. He had sent a note to a reporter about what he was doing and why he was doing it, presumably in the belief that the reporter would wait until after he had blown up the bomb and in the process killed himself to put out his manifesto, as it were. So, you know, you've got a guy who's clearly mentally ill, I would say, at the very least. But he was trying to blow himself up on the National Mall in order to promote an idea that actually might be an interesting thing to have a conversation about. So I'm going to set aside the guy, the crazy guy, I'm not even going to mention his name, and get right to sortition, this political system that he was advocating. Sortition is the way we pick juries. The way that we pick juries is everybody who is eligible to be on a jury, everybody who is presumably a citizen and the age of majority. And different states do it in different ways. Some states it's off the voting rolls, other states it's off the driver's license rolls. You know, it varies around the country. But basically, the idea is if you can get a really, really large pool of people, and then in a genuinely random way, select from that pool of people a small group that will do the business that needs to be done. In the case of a jury, it's deciding guilt or innocence. In the case of a legislature, it's passing laws. It's governing a country. If you can do that, then you will have in the example of the jury or in the example of the legislature, you will have a jury or a legislature that actually represents the community. Now, our juries have not really pulled this off successfully, in large part because they've typically been drawn from voting, from registered voters, and registered voters have always tended to be older and whiter. Although that may be changing. Brian Kemp's efforts to block 56,000 or 65,000 or whatever it was, largely African-American voters in Georgia from being on the rolls, which we talked about at some length yesterday. But, you know, this is the deal. You know, John Adams in 1776, he said that a representative assembly should be in miniature an exact portrait of the people at large. Now, of course, by people he was referring to white men back then, but still, you get the point. And so here we have right now a legislature where 80% of the people in the House and Senate are male. They spend 4 hours a day asking people for money. Michael Schulson wrote a great piece about this for the Daily Beast, some time ago. I think it was a few years ago. The median net worth is $900,000, and about a third of them are lawyers. Now that it doesn't even begin to resemble the American public, the American populace. So what if we simply put the names, not of registered voters, but of all Americans over the age of, say, 25, into a computer that had a random, that had the ability to do a genuine random thing, and it pulled out 435 people and said, okay, here's your legislators. You know, as your random sample gets larger, you tend to get closer and closer to a sample that actually mirrors the population. It's called the law of large numbers. And by the way, this is how ancient Athens did it. The polis was 6,000 people who were drawn by, they actually had a machine that got the got the names out in a way that couldn't be corrupted, which is kind of cool. And so if we did this, number one, you'd have a legislature that was 50-50 men and women right off the bat. Number two, they'd be less wealthy, less educated, and fewer white people. Number three, the members would not be beholden to any special interests. And only a few of them would be lawyers. Oh, and you'd have a lot more young people. Is sortition a system, picking our legislators the same way we pick our juries, is that an idea we should consider? It's kind of interesting. It's almost kind of cool, but, on the one hand. On the other hand, really, I think you could build a strong case that the biggest problem that we have with our political system right now is money. You know, the big cancer in our political system is money from the Kochs and these other billionaires, and they have just corrupted our political process. But what do you think? I mean, is this totally crazy? I mean, this is, keep in mind, the Athenian democracy is what we patterned our democracy after. It's why juries are the way they are. And this is how they did it. This is how the ancient Greeks did it. I don't know. I think it might be something, it'd be fascinating to see a state try this. But, this would require legislators to say, we're going to give up our own power, which is pretty unlikely. So anyhow, I wanted to share that with you. The Supreme Court, we now know what is happening on the Supreme Court as a consequence of Brett Kavanaugh being on it. Had Merrick Garland been on the court, all the observers of this are pretty sure this ruling would not have happened. But Tuesday of this week, the first day of the first session of the Supreme Court that Brett Kavanaugh is on, the court struck down a lower court ruling that had struck down a Republican law in North Dakota that made it nearly impossible for tens of thousands of Native Americans to vote in North Dakota. In North Dakota, because of the way mail delivery is handled and because of the way, it's sovereign land versus private land and is it part of the United States, is it a sovereign nation, all this kind of stuff. For those reasons, principally, and because there's so much poverty, but, mostly actually it has to do with it being a reservation. Most people who live on the reservation in North Dakota, anyway, don't have a street address. They have a post office box. And, we're talking about 70,000 North Dakotans, 20% of the turnout in a presidential election in North Dakota, 20% of the voters have a post office box as their address. So the Republicans passed a law saying that if you want to vote, you must have ID that has an actual physical address on it, not a post office box. It was just a very straightforward way of knocking 70,000 Native Americans off the voting rolls. And a lower court said, this is racist crapola. You can't do this. And the Supreme Court, in a split decision, again, had Merrick Garland been on the court, he would have struck this down. I mean, we know this from his record on the D.C. Circuit. But Brett Kavanaugh was like, oh, this is cool. And so with a one-vote majority, they blocked the lower court order that was blocking this law, and they put this Republican law into effect. So we have seen now the first bit of Brett Kavanaugh doing his thing. And it's obscene, in my opinion. This is just absolutely obscene. We have this massive Hurricane Michael, that just hit the Gulf Coast. It's now heading up through the Carolinas and Georgia and all that stuff, heading up toward D.C. and then New York. And in the path, one of the things a lot of us don't think about are the prisoners in the path. Now, prisons are probably not, you know, they're not built like trailer parks. They're not going to blow away. Although apparently at least one prison has lost part of its roof. But the power goes down. I mean, yeah, they've got emergency generators because prisons are so electrified, you know, all the gates and locks and things. So and they plan for hurricanes, obviously, because this is hurricane country. But, you know, it's still not a good thing or a good time. And there was an effort, you know, in fact, there was a phone banking effort yesterday to or a couple days ago to get them to move the prisoners, which they didn't do. We've been looking around. Nate was looking around this morning for any reports of any injuries or anything like that. We haven't found any. But if you know of anything that has to do with this issue, you know, give us a shout. Yesterday at some length, you know, I'm going to pick this up on the other side of the break. Yesterday there was this op-ed that was published under the name of Donald Trump. Apparently it was just a White House press release that an editor at USA Today thought, this is pretty cool, let's put it in USA Today and let's tweet it out to our 3.6 million Twitter followers. And literally every sentence was a lie. I'll tell you all about this. We'll talk about this a little bit more just on the other side of this break. It's 17 and a half minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with your calls, more of the news of the day, right after this. Stick around. And welcome back. Carol in Manassas, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carol, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about sortition?
Yeah. Hey, Dr. Tom, how are you doing?
I am well. What's up?
Good. I got my flu shot today.
Oh, good.
I got the one you recommended or that you had.
Yeah, yeah.
People need to ask questions when they go get their flu shot.
They do, or any shot. You know, is it possible to get the single-dose vaccine that doesn't have the mercury in it? And is it possible to get a higher-potency vaccine that doesn't have the adjuvant, the aluminum in it?
Exactly. I wrote down what you said and took it with me.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not why I called. I called about the sortition.
Mm-hmm.
The problem I have, what sets my hair on fire when I vote, excuse me, is I've never once in the congressional, in the midterm votes, I call them the congressional votes, I don't vote for the military-industrial complex. I don't vote for GE or the fossil fuel industry. I don't vote for David or Charles Koch, and yet that's who's making the policies of the people that I'm putting in there. And that just really aggravates me. And if we don't get the money out of this, I don't think that even sortition would work, because poor people or average people can be bribed as well as the wealthy people.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this a lot, Carol, and it seems to me that the only way that I can see, and this is, you know, kind of roundabout and convoluted, we've got to knock down the 1976 Buckley versus Vallejo decision that for the first time in American history said, you know, money in politics is the same thing as free speech and it's protected by the Constitution. And the only way, there's only two ways to do that, that I know of, that are actually, you know, functional, useful, effective, have been done in the past. And the first is to have the composition of the Supreme Court change so that they strike that down. We missed that opportunity in 2000. Had George W. Bush not been given the White House by the Supreme Court, and had Donald Trump not been given the White House by the Russians, we would right now have a 7-2 liberal majority on the court, and odds are they would have struck that down, but we don't have that. And the second way is by a constitutional amendment, which is even more unlikely. So what I'm suggesting is that the next time Democrats take the White House, the House, and the Senate, they should pass a law expanding the size of the Supreme Court, adding 2 or 4 new justices. The Democratic president should immediately appoint those justices with the idea, just like Trump appointed Kavanaugh and Gorsuch with the idea that he'd overturn Roe v. Wade. In this case, it would be with the idea that they will overturn the Buckley decision in Citizens United. They overturn those decisions, and then Congress can pass laws limiting money in politics, which I believe Congress would actually be enthusiastic about doing. You know, boom, you know, damage undone. But, you know,
what we're seeing now, for example, you take someone as nice as Beto O'Rourke in Texas,
mm-hmm.
but now all the October surprise money has been rolling in.
Yep.
And guess what? The most deplorable man in the Senate, Ted Cruz, is way ahead of Beto O'Rourke.
Yep.
I mean, things like that just really make my previously red hair go on fire.
There you go. Carol, thanks for the call. We're hitting a break here, but thank you very much. Yeah, I don't think sortition is going to solve that problem. And it's pretty unlikely to become law, but it's a fascinating thing to know about and think about. Anyhow, it's coming up on 22 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 22 minutes, 15 seconds past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. So if we had sortition and your number came up to serve in the legislature, would you do it? That's perhaps a more interesting question. But, you know, what do we do? Okay, I was talking about Trump's USA Today op-ed yesterday, and in the second or third hour of our program, I literally went through and I read every sentence on the air and rebutted it on the air. Nobody else, to the best of my knowledge, was talking about this. I was flipped out. I mean, I was just like, how can USA Today publish and promote a, quote, op-ed by Donald Trump that literally is filled with lies? I mean, every single sentence, I was able to rebut the lies in this thing. And I was so pleased this morning to see in the Washington Post the fact checker, Glenn Kessler's fact checker. The opening sentence kind of says it all. President Trump wrote an opinion article for USA Today on October 10th regarding proposals to expand Medicare to all Americans, known as Medicare for All, in which almost every sentence contained a misleading statement or a falsehood. Now, USA Today is the largest newspaper in America. What the hell is the largest newspaper in America doing, publishing an op-ed by a pathological liar in which literally every sentence is a lie or implies a lie? Literally every sentence. What the hell is going on over at Gannett? I would love to know, where did this come from? Who put this thing in the newspaper? Whose idea was this? How is it that when the White House, this was apparently, one of the stories I've heard, and I've been looking for the link to this in the documentation on it, I've been unable to find it. One of the stories that I heard is that this was actually a press release that was sent out to the media that some eager beaver editor at USA Today looked at and said, oh, this is cool. Look at this. Let's see if we can put Donald Trump's name on this and publish this. And they contacted the White House, and the White House said, sure, go for it. And boom, there it is. But, if I was a reporter, and I'm not, I'm an opinion person, right? This show is not news. We talk about the news. But you're getting my take on it, and I'm getting your take on it, and it's more like a national town hall. But, I was a reporter at one point in time. For 7 years, I was a reporter in Lansing, Michigan for WITL, AM and FM. And I can tell you, and we also published a trade industry magazine, Terry O'Connor and I did for a couple of years. I can tell you that back in the days when I was actually doing journalism, if a political party or a politician, or in the case, I was in Lansing, Michigan, so if Jerry Graves, the mayor, I think he was the mayor for the entire time I was working at Whittle, or the governor, were to send out a press release to my radio station or to our trade publication, to our newspaper, that was literally filled with lies, that would be the story, right? The story would be, look at this, the mayor's office just sent out a press release that's got 27 lies in it. What the hell is going on in the mayor's office? That would have been the story. So how is it that USA Today gets this literally pack of lies, and the Washington Post now has pointed this out, literally gets a pack of lies, or a stack of lies, I guess you could call it. And instead of running an article about, isn't it insane that the White House is sending out news releases filled with lies? Instead of writing that story, which would actually be reporting, USA Today publishes these lies under Donald Trump's name as an op-ed. I mean, this scares me more than a whole lot of things that have happened in the recent past. This is Weimar Republic kind of stuff. This is when the press becomes the lapdog of the government, of the leadership of the government. Now, I know that we've got this with Fox News. We've had this with Fox News now ever since Fox News was created. Fox News was created by billionaire Rupert Murdoch, the same reason that he created much of the press in that he owns in Australia and in the United Kingdom, to promote his own political viewpoint, to promote the political and economic interests of the billionaire class. That's why Rupert Murdoch did this. And it's obvious to anybody who looks at it. But USA Today and Gannett pretend to be news. So when the White House sends them a bunch of lies, why don't they write a story about how, gee, the White House sent us a bunch of lies?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
What am I missing here? Or is our free press going the way of the Italian fascists in 34? Welcome back. On the line with us, our old friend, Dr. Michael Mann, the distinguished professor of meteorology and director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University, author of several books, including The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. He's the inventor of the hockey stick, that giant lurch up in carbon dioxide that Al Gore, that made Al Gore famous. This is the guy who actually invented the concept. You can tweet him at Michael E. Mann, his website, Michael Mann with two N's, MANN.net. Dr. Mann, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Always good to be with you.
So the IPCC, in response to a query, this wasn't their normal five-year report. This was in response to an inquiry from from some of these island nations that are looking at the possibility of extinction, essentially, vanishing under the waters. Asked them, is this a goal of keeping temperatures below, 2 degrees was the original to Celsius?
Originally 2 degrees Celsius, and this they're looking at an even lower target here, right, of 1.5.
Right. Right. So they said, what would the consequences be if we lowered the goal? And this whole new bunch of research in the last couple of years came out, and it's kind of head exploding. Tell us summarize it for us, please.
Sure. Well, there are a lot of reasons to believe that 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet is a whole lot worse than 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is a whole lot worse than the 1 degree Celsius we've already warmed. And the issue here really has to do, for example, with how close are we to the collapse of substantial parts of the major ice sheets, the West Antarctic ice sheet, the Greenland ice sheet. If those ice sheets continue to lose ice as they have been doing, then it may be indeed too late for many of these low-lying island nations. The amount of sea level rise that we'll see over the next several decades will literally submerge some of these islands. So they have reason to be worried about any additional warming. And whereas 2 degrees Celsius warming is the target that has largely been adopted in these discussions for defining dangerous interference with the climate, for these low-lying island nations, 1.5 degrees Celsius is catastrophic. For many of the regions that are suffering unprecedented droughts and heat waves and wildfires, we've already warmed a dangerous amount. And so it's really a question of how far down this dangerous highway are we willing to go?
Yeah. And how far are we willing to go, apparently?
Well, in the absence of any, mitigation, and, if we pursue business as usual, burning of fossil fuels, and warm the planet by 4 to 5 Celsius, that's 7 to 9 Fahrenheit by the end of the century, then we will see truly devastating climate change impacts. The devastating summer of 2018 with the wildfires and floods and the superstorms we've seen this fall, most recently my namesake, Michael, a devastating storm, that's the strongest storm ever to landfall the U.S. coastline this late in the season. That will be par for the course, and we'll see far more devastating extreme weather events, hurricanes, massive sea level rise and flooding. That's a world that we certainly don't want to live in. We don't want our children and grandchildren to live in. If we curtail our burning of fossil fuels dramatically in the years ahead, we can still avoid warming the planet more than 2 degrees Celsius, and we certainly don't want to warm it any more than that. The Paris Agreement basically gets us halfway from that 4 to 5 Celsius, 7 to 9 Fahrenheit warming, down to the 2 degrees Celsius warming that pretty much everybody agrees we want to keep warming below. The Paris Agreement commitments get us about halfway there. That means we still have work to do.
Well, this report is essentially calling for a massive reduction within the next 10 to 12 years. Can you give us the specifics that they're calling for in terms of reductions? And, you know, having established that it'll be a disaster if we don't do this, I mean, we've got several Republicans now who have come out and said, literally have made fun of it. I mean, you know, three Republican members of Congress in the last 24 hours, one of them made the comment, you know, it would take all the money in the world to do this, which is BS. You know, another made a similar comment. What specifically are they saying we have to do and we have to start doing right now?
Yeah, and of course, it is a disingenuous talking point to say it will cost us dearly to act, because the reality is it will cost us dearly to not act.
Well, and it already is. I mean, look at Hurricane Michael.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And the devastating extreme weather events, the wildfires and droughts and floods that we've seen this summer, already the cost of inaction is so much greater than the cost of actually taking action. And so that is a disingenuous talking point, and it's predictable. The forces of denial are out in force trying to distract the public and policymakers in the wake of this devastating new IPCC report. And here's the irony, Tom. This report is overly conservative, as the IPCC reports always are. And in terms of the budget of carbon, how much carbon do we have left that we can burn and still avoid warming the planet more than that dangerous 2 degrees Celsius warming? We have argued that the number that the IPCC is using is probably a factor of 2 too large, in part because what it gets into some of the details here, the way they measure how much the planet has warmed, obviously you need to define what the baseline is. What is the pre-industrial baseline? Now, they use the late 1800s to define the pre-industrial baseline, but the globe had already warmed several tenths of a degree Celsius in response to greenhouse gas emissions that occurred before the late 19th century. So if you use a more realistic definition of what was the pre-industrial climate, we're actually even closer to 2 degrees Celsius, and we have even less carbon that we can afford to burn. So what do the numbers say? We've got to bring our carbon emissions down by between 5 and 10% a year over the next 2 decades, and basically bring them down to zero if we're going to avoid warming the planet more than that dangerous 2 degrees Celsius warming.
Right. And this, by the way, would create millions of jobs. I mean, it would be an explosion for the clean energy industry, you know, rebuilding our power grids, solarizing every house in the world. It would be such an incredible economic opportunity. But the fossil fuel barons would take a hit. The billionaires, the Koch brothers, the stockholders of ExxonMobil and whatnot, they would all take a hit. And, therefore, they're fighting it tooth and nail. It's just absolutely absolutely bizarre.
Yeah, no, I mean, the great lie, you know, has been that we can't make this transition. It'll hurt the economy. When in fact, the rest of the world has moved on. The rest of the world is moving on. They recognize that the future of the global economy is in renewable energy, and the more we continue to remain fixated on fossil fuels, the farther we as a nation fall behind the rest of the world. And you're right. You know, there's some coal barons and fossil fuel companies that stand to profit the longer we stay addicted to fossil fuels. But the rest of us and the planet lose out.
All right. Let's talk for a moment about the actual impacts of this. I've been accused of having my hair on fire around these issues in the past, particularly when I talk about mass extinctions, you know, the revisiting the Permian. But let's talk about just, you know, kind of a middle point here, civilization. We have already seen I believe, as a consequence of global warming, and please reality check me on this, we've seen the desert move south. I believe it's over 100 miles in the last 2 decades in the northern part of Africa and the Middle East. And the consequence of that was, you know, farmers being wiped out, moving into the big cities. Yep. The big cities then becoming unstable in countries like Syria, Libya, Egypt, and so forth. And leading to what was referred to as the Arab Spring. Apparently, it was provoked by climate change. Then you've got all these refugees flowing into Europe at a rate that is difficult for the Europeans to assimilate, which is producing a right-wing backlash. So now we've had several governments in Europe, Poland, Hungary, Italy may be on the edge of this, basically flipping from democracy to strongman autocracy, rejecting democracy. And then in other parts of the world, Bangladesh, some parts of northern India, we're seeing, you know, just massive movements of people, millions and millions of people moving in as a consequence of climate change. At what point, so clearly, A, it's already destructive to democracy, this fragile form of governance that we've kind of evolved over the last couple hundred years, and B, tell me if you agree with everything I just said, and then if so, B, at what point do we say this actually endangers civilization?
Yeah, well, you know, these granola-chewing radicals known as the Pentagon and four-star generals, our national security community, they are firmly on record in terms of the threat that they see in climate change. They describe it as a threat multiplier. It takes existing competition for diminishing resources, and it increases that competition, and it creates conflict. And you can connect the dots between this epic drought in Syria and the terrorist organization ISIS that arose in that atmosphere of conflict and instability. Even if you dismiss climate change for all the other reasons, if you're a national security hawk, you ought to care about climate change because it is our greatest national security threat. And our armed forces understand that. And our national security community understands that. The Pentagon understands that. Many of our business leaders understand that as well because they, you know, lose out in an unstable world economy. So, you know, it used to be the case that climate change was sort of thought of as an issue that only the environmental left cares about or should care about. But it doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum. The impacts of climate change are already very real. They're hurting all of us, and we should all care regardless of our politics.
Yeah, yeah, this is serious stuff. This is very serious stuff, and we need to treat it as such. Dr. Michael Mann, his latest book, The Madhouse Effect. What was the title of your book about the hockey stick?
The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars.
The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. That was absolutely brilliant. Dr. Michael Mann, michaelmann.net. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You too.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. It is 46 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Let's pick up some of your phone calls here. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to KPFK.
Hi, Tom. I was really interested, and you know what? I'm so glad you read the Smedley Butler. The thing you were talking about, the juries and picking governments and stuff, things have to change. Things aren't working.
Yeah.
People aren't representing us.
Yeah, I'm not sure the sortition is the answer, although it would be fascinating to see, you know, maybe a town do it for the city council kind of thing or something like that. I mean, although that may not be a large enough sample.
It has to be more than a one-prong approach.
Yeah.
We have to, you know, I mean, the media is not what it used to be. It used to be a lot more diverse.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have things that kept people, corporations, and it used to be illegal for corporations to give money to politicians.
The Tillman Act was passed in 1907 and outlawed that, and that got overturned by the Buckley decision in 76.
And I, you know, and I would think that, you know, that a president, one person picking the Supreme Court is doesn't seem right. And it, that jury thing would might be good for to have a bunch of people that, you know, a sort of a type of jury to pick a Supreme Court justice.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if you did if you did sortition among all the lawyers in America to go on the Supreme Court, because I don't think you'd want somebody on the court who wasn't a lawyer.
Had many, many great people on the Supreme Court who weren't lawyers.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, well, you know, in the first century and a half, in the first century and a half, we basically didn't even have law schools early on. I mean, it certainly.
What's very scary is that the way they rigged the system is that they've attacked the freedom of speech. I mean, for you used to be able to take the bar exam and become a lawyer. Now you have to be indoctrinated into a law school,
right?
And things like that. I mean, it's
when I was in my 30s.
Little that they take these things away from us, and all of a sudden the water's boiling, and we don't know what to do.
Yeah, I remember when I was in my 30s, there was a correspondence school, a mail order school, law school. And if you took their course, actually, you didn't even have to take their course, but, you know, their sales pitch was the California bar and the D.C. bar both do not, at that point in time, I'm sure the law has changed since then, but at that point in time, both of those, whatever you call them, jurisdictions, did not require you to graduate from law school. They only required you to pass the bar exam. And I ordered up this course, and for a couple of months I was studying law like crazy, thinking this is going to be a lot of fun. And then it just, you know, I got busy and it got overwhelming, and I just gave up on it. I was also running a business at the time in Atlanta, in Atlanta. But it was, maybe we should consider going back to some. Of course, we used to also not have standards for doctors, which was a problem. I don't know. I guess you could argue either side of that, but. Anyhow, sortition. You're in favor of limited sortition.
We have to start experimenting. We have to do a Continental Congress because these people aren't representing us. And when Republicans and Democrats are getting their money from the same people and always can agree about war, there's something seriously wrong here in America.
Yeah, I agree. On the war issue, absolutely. It's a big issue. John, thank you. We'll be back. It's coming up on, 10 minutes before the hour. Boy, what a day. What a day. What an enormous amount of stuff going on. Tony in Huntsville, Alabama. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm well.
I was trying to catch the beginning of your rant, which I hate missing it because I love the show and I always catch that beginning of your rant. I'm not really sure what the definition of what is it, sortition?
Sortition, yeah. It's basically how juries work. Juries work by sortition. It's you take a large pool of citizens, the largest possible pool, and you randomly select people from it, and you get a representative slice of the larger population.
Okay, let me ask you this. This may be a little off topic, but I think it kind of fits in. Let's say you had a bunch of felons or inmates or guys who, like me, who don't have representation but pay taxes, mm-hmm. and they wanted to get a pardon, and they volunteered themselves to the city, local, municipal governments as staffers, as a way to get a pardon and get their voting rights back. Would you say that that would be about the same as a public official? Somebody just working, volunteering, don't give us a reduced rate.
Sure.
But we're basically paying back because remember, it's XYZ versus the people.
Right.
So we're paying the people back by representing the people at a reduced somebody's staffer.
You're in Alabama. You're in Huntsville, Alabama. Alabama is one of a few states. It's a minority of states. It's principally the Old South, where if you committed a felony and you have served your time, you're off parole or probation, You're now, you know, back in society as a full member of society. In most of the states of the United States, your right to vote is restored. In Alabama, in Florida, in a few other southern states, that right is gone for the rest of your life. That is wrong, in my opinion. So, you know, how I rather than trying to figure out a way for ex-felons to work their way back to having voting rights and being fully, you know, full members of society, we need to change those laws. And so I would say, you know, rather than you know, arguing should we allow felons to, ex-felons to, you know, use voluntary service as a way of earning their citizenship, I would say they already earned their citizenship back by serving their time.
Absolutely, and working for absolutely free in the prison system. We did everything from the administrative work to running the kitchens, running. I was a captain's runner, which means I had all of his major paperwork. I did everything, all the filing except for his signature. Mm-hmm. It was the only thing I didn't have the power to do. Yeah. But when you have that kind of experience, they take it all from you when you get out because you can't get a job. But the whole point is, we have no representation at all, and we're tens of thousands of people.
You're right. You're right.
Tens of thousands.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the further south you go in America, the higher those numbers get. Tony, thanks for the call. This is something we all need to commit ourselves to, and you know, to ending felon disenfranchisement. Ivan in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on 95.3 FM, one of our Pacifica affiliates there. Hey, Ivan, what's up?
Hi. I was just wondering what you thought of whether the profit motive of capitalism would survive global warming or not.
Well, it's the profit motive of capitalism that is causing global warming, unfortunately.
Well, that's what I was thinking. And do we need to start talking about alternatives to capitalism right now, because it doesn't seem to be working?
Yeah. I think that conversation is one we've been having for a long, long time. And certainly we've been having it a big way since the 1860s when Karl Marx published Das Kapital, or Kapital. And then Marx and Engels, you know, the Communist Manifesto a few years later. That conversation kind of went sideways with the Soviet Union and Mao, who took the idea of communism, this really neat idea of everybody kind of, you know, it was Jesus' idea, right? I mean, you know, his merry band, everybody, they had the common purse. Judas was the one who was in charge of the common purse. That's communism. And turned it into a national thing. But it didn't work. And I think that communism works really, really well in small communities where everybody knows each other, because it does require a certain kind of honor system piece to it. But when it's possible for people to be anonymous, communism starts to break down. Now, the question of capitalism is, can capitalism be used to undo the damage of capitalism? I mean, that was the whole idea of cap and trade. And cap and trade actually successfully worked to stop sulfur dioxide emissions. And it was George Herbert Walker Bush who got that legislation passed, the cap and trade on sulfur dioxide. And, you know, we could do that. We could do cap and trade. In fact, several European nations have already done this with carbon dioxide. I think a carbon tax is a much more straightforward way to do it. But I don't see capitalism going away any day soon, Ivan, as much as I would like it to.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.